Hey, did you guys know that today is World Password Day?
World Password Day? No. Are you serious?
Yeah, go to google.com on the front page. I thought it was appropriate that we're podcasting today. It's World Password Day.
I just didn't believe you. I'm looking at the front page.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's World Password Day. Take a security checkup to strengthen your account.
Yeah. So for all of you who are listening to this the same day we're recording it, which is zero, go check it out. If not, take a security checkup with Google. They actually have World Password. I'm sure they'll have this link for a while. But
and tomorrow is password. International Hack Carl Day.
Mm. I think that's every day.
So what's up, guys?
Oh, lots of stuff. Lots of the usual suspects today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you have a good week?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been busy. Lots of new hacks.
You did some hacking too, I assume, because that's what you do.
Yes. Yeah. We've been inventing some new and fun things, which I wish I could tell our listeners about. But.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know if they'd want to hear it.
But we can't kill that many people.
No.
Well, Dwayne.
No,
can.
But seriously, like I talk to just my friends who aren't in tech or even family, and I tell them some of these things, and it's I get two looks. One's the glassy eyed, I could care less look,
right.
And then the other is I'm horrified and I'm about to set my PC on fire look.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get into the story. So shall we start with the Russian hackers story?
Fancy bear.
What?
Russian hackers compromise embassy emails to target governments. Yeah, it's Cozy Bear.
Yeah, no Fancy Bear.
Is it bad that I can't tell them apart sometimes?
Not to me.
So Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear are both well-known organizations, hacking organizations aligned with Russia.
Yeah.
And Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear are both, they might be the same organization and they're just differentiated by teams and things like that, but they're involved in hacking embassies. And the saddest part about this story is this, if you look in it, this is a bleeping computer story. They talk about the fact that they used valid email addresses from organizations to send the email. And what I think that means is they picked organizations that would have reason to email the embassies, but didn't put DMARC and DKIM and the other things that would protect spoofing in place.
We don't know what that is. What is that?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
So you definitely should sidetrack and explain those. But the other way that this happens as well, and there's a big sort of, this is a pretty systemic thing right now in hacking and APT groups.
APT? Man, we're swimming in acronyms right now. And right. I got two on the stack.
So APT is Advanced Persistent Threat. Basically, bad guys. Dwayne. Okay. Dwayne would be an APT. If
I would
out.
Be if I didn't if I wasn't
for if he wasn't
for, the, good
for the powers of good. All right, so it's a thing.
Right, it's a thing. But one of the things, and I think I'm 99% sure I saw CISA actually put a tweet out, and I'll go find it so we can post the link.
Mm-hmm.
But another way that this is happening right now is that that advanced persistent threats, hackers, bad guys are breaking into your organization's email with a valid username and password.
Wow.
And then they're sending emails to other people in the organization. So it's not right.
And
it's
that's
not
classic.
You know, they're yes, spoofing and Patrick, you should go with, talk about the DMARC and all that.
Well, we're talking about the fact that there's two ways to do this. Let's say I'm trying to get to Dwayne, and who isn't? So I'm trying to get to Dwayne. And I know that he has association with two different people, Patrick and Carl. And so what I'm going to try to do with Carl is I'm going to try to break into his email and send the email as Carl. That's the one that Dwayne's talking about. And that's definitely possible. But he's got to break into your email system to be able to then go after Dwayne. So it's not an obvious thing. Another way to do it is I can write a program, and we're all programmers here. I can write a program in a minute that will send an email as anyone in the world that I want to send an email as. But there's technologies that have been put in place called DMARC, DKIM, SPF. They're DNS settings that you can put in your DNS system that makes it so that emails will only be accepted if they're sent from your mail server for your domain. That's very good feature, very good functionality.
Well, I thought that seems like it should be on by default.
It should be, but the problem is it's not complicated to set up, but it's not trivial either. And it does tend to catch things that are false positives.
Okay.
And so it adds work. And there's three ways to set up DMARC. You can set it up as open. There's a bunch of companies out there that set up DMARC and then just left it open. Mm-hmm. There's setting up DMARC and quarantining, and then you have to have an administrator check the quarantine to see what mails have been caught in it. And that's extra overhead. And people are lazy. And then there's enabled, which is basically deny. It's going to actually deny the message coming through, and nobody, it's just not going to get through. And so valid emails that get denied are going to cause frustration. So what happens is most organizations set up this stuff, and then they turn it on, and then they turn it off very quickly. And then they forget about it. And if someone says, do you have DMARC? Oh yeah, we've got it all set up, but they're not using it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. If everyone did this, the world would be a safer place.
So for you, Joe listener, or Josephine listener, or whatever, you can go to your IT guy and say, hey, do you have DMARC enabled on our email server? And what mode is it in?
And what mode is it in? Is it in? Is it off, quarantining, or enabled?
It should be enabled.
If it's either quarantine or enabled, the only way it gives you any protection. Otherwise, it's just checking the box, because you're basically, it's like having a house alarm you never arm. It's not super convenient. I'll be honest with you. We've had it, and we've oscillated between quarantine and deny. And deny is pretty rigorous, but then you have to have somebody check it.
You know, I used to have a smoke detector in near my kitchen.
You used to.
And I took it out because I cook.
Yeah. And it keeps going off?
Keeps going off when I cook.
That makes sense.
And I have a hood. Like, I have fans. I have, you know, it just kept going off. So I'm, you know.
You sound like the person who, like, hey, I have this surge protector and it keeps popping. So I just jammed a penny in there. And
yeah.
It's all good now. It's
all
fine.
Good.
It's right.
Yep. Yeah. It doesn't.
And, you know, I never get errors when I build my software because I have a debugger switch that turns off the error reporting.
That's good. And it's 100%.
All those pesky errors just go away.
I read a story about a guy who was driving a pickup truck and he blew a fuse. And so he put a 22 caliber round in.
Oh, what could happen?
And it went off and hit him in sensitive areas. It was a Darwin Award story from long ago. So after the show, we're going to go down at Carl's and do an intervention on fire prevention.
You know, the Darwin Award story about the 911 call for, I can't remember who it was, but somebody in a truck basically saying they've been shot in the head and their brains are spilling out into their hands.
Wow.
And, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? Yes, I can feel my brains. And what actually happened was this person went shopping and got some like Pillsbury poppin' fresh dough in a can. And it was a hot day and it was hanging in the back of the, I guess some pickup trucks have like a gun rack or whatever. So there's like a thing in back of your head.
Yeah.
So it was basically in back of the person's head and it exploded and they went, what? You know, and then felt back there and they felt all the goo.
The hot dough.
There's an actual 911 call. I got shot in the head. My brains are spilling out.
Should you be concerned that you can still talk cogently without having any brains?
It depends. Sometimes, you know, depending on what part of the brain you injure, you can still function.
Thinking was not a big pastime for this person.
All right. Shall we move on?
So DMARC. So we learned a little bit about DMARC. Everybody should look into it. And the world would be a better place. But Dwayne's right. You could also get around it by hacking other people. So supply chain. Right. This is a supply chain attack. So there's the Russians. And now our next story is about our other favorite actor, which is Microsoft.
Do, do, do.
And it actually combines two topics that we talk about a lot, Microsoft and Log4j.
Log4j. Who doesn't like Log4j?
Yeah. So the headline is Microsoft observed many attackers adding exploits of Log4j vulnerabilities.
And that's obviously, that makes sense. Basically, if I'm an attacker and I'm looking to troll and get systems, I'm going to take all of the worst and nastiest stuff and put it into my exploits. So we saw this kind of uptick when Eternal Blue came out many years ago, which was one of the hacking tools that the NSA had been using. If you got stuff that works against a wide array of systems and it's a devastating attack, you're going to see it added to the kit and used more and more.
Yeah, often. And here yeah. again, Mr. or Mrs. Listener, if you haven't patched Log4j yet, there are numerous patches out there that fix all these issues. So I come back to patch, patch, patch.
Patchy, patch, patch.
Yep, absolutely. But Log4j is the gift that keeps on giving from the security world.
So this might also mean that this is starting to slide into the domain of the script kiddies. And it probably did fairly quickly. So some exploits takes a long time before they get scriptable to a point where somebody with no real technical knowledge can apply them. This is not one of those. This is very right. easy to use. I could see a very large army of very unsophisticated people starting to use it, and that would explain why Microsoft's seeing a lot more
right.
of these attacks.
Right. Yeah, and it is interesting because you'll start to see these things, this type or style of exploits start to get woven into much more complicated attacks, I think. Like the first wave was, this thing is so easy to exploit, let's just run a real quick script and, you know, get a shell on a remote box and have it run a command. But I think you'll start to see these things heavily embedded, like deep inside of either ransomware or whatever, because they'll be able to gain access to more internal systems. Because right now, I think a lot of people say, okay, well, if I'm not running any Log4jable stuff that's accessible to the internet, I'm good, right? I don't need to worry about patching
right.
because, you know, maybe it's running on some old, you know, internal, I don't know, Java, Jenkins, whatever type server that nobody has access to except for people who are on the local network. And the problem is if malicious code then runs on that local network, you know, you're going to be in trouble. Actually, we saw that with VMware Horizon, right? So a lot of people had internal VMware Horizon servers that they were like, you know what? We'll patch them at some point, but they're up and running, they're production, we're not going to touch them, and nobody can get to them from the internet anyway, so who cares? And then we started to see normal ransomware delivery pipelines of email, phishing, that sort of stuff, and then start to use Log4j to then compromise more on the inside.
Yeah. Hey, I have a hypothetical question for you.
Yes, sir.
Is cheating at gaming a gateway drug?
Oh, my God. Sometimes I don't know if it's the hacking community that's ahead or the game cheaters.
I think they're the same community, man. That's how I started.
I don't know. Let's bring this back a little bit. Bushidutokennet.net. There's a blog about game cheaters and how, if you want to keep an eye on the hacking community, like the cutting edge of exploits and that sort of stuff, start watching the game cheating community right now. And it is honestly, it's 1,000% true. Me and my team, we write viruses, malware, all sorts of stuff all day long. And the bane of our existence is trying to find unique and interesting ways to hook into the low-level operating system and bypass antivirus and bypass EDRs so that endpoint EDRs. Detection. So something that's going to find at the client malicious code running and stop us. We don't want that to happen. So if we can run lower and deeper in the operating system than they can, well, then they can't find us. And every time we do a search, every time we find, we get kicked out by, you know, Defender or something along those lines, and we do a search, okay, there's this error, or how do I get to this level of the kernel or whatever, every response that comes back is game hacking. Every single one of them. It's because take really, really popular games, your Modern Warfares and that sort of stuff. If you're the team that can create an aimbot, right? And for those of you who don't play games, an aimbot is where you load a piece of code up on your desktop and then you play the game. And as you're playing the game, the aimbot hooks at such a low level into the game, it knows where everybody is. It knows where they're all standing.
You never miss.
And you never miss. You're halfway across the map with a handgun and your guy just spins and shoots at somebody who's halfway across the map in a building, right? Because you know where they are. Right. And wow. and the aimbot calculates, can I hit him? Can I shoot through whatever is in front of him? That sort of stuff. But the game industry is so against that. They've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in discovering these types of hacks. So the game hacking community is at the cutting edge of making sure that these that they can still hack and exploit these systems.
Interesting. So yeah, so they hack the game because it's fun, right? Because you can actually
it can be hugely profitable.
Oh, really? So there's an industry.
Oh yeah,
there's an industry built up here.
Oh yeah. It talks. This article talks about a $10 subscription that netted $75 million, over $75 million.
Man, I'm in the wrong business. You know, I am writing business software, making a good living, and thinking, you know, yeah, I'm happy, I'm comfortable. You know, it's just a matter of what you write.
Yeah.
Well, it's what you write.
So think of it this way: when people start getting into computers. They're going to either go to the nth degree or they're not. But even if they're going to go all the way to become, you know, super hackers,
right,
or network architects, they have to get their stripes somewhere. They have to get their feet wet. And a lot of people will do it in college when they have mostly games that are the object of their obsession.
Right.
They have nothing but time. And for the most part, the thing that frustrates them in life is, I want to get to this level. I want to kill this boss. I want to beat this jerk. For me, it was a PC-based games that I was playing alone, and I was trying to figure out whether they were winnable. So I was trying to dump the variables and figure out how they were programmed and things like that. Now, no online cheating or anything like that. But now it's about winning in drugs in weightlifting or in other sports, because people make money in Fortnite. People make money in Call of Duty tournaments.
Well, and imagine this. There have been several documented cases of streamers. So people on Twitch or people on, you know, whatever, YouTube streams, that sort of stuff, where they're streaming their gameplay and they're awesome. Like, they can jump up and through what's called 360 no scope. They're like, they don't actually look down the end of the rifle. They can just shoot someone in the head at, you know, halfway across the field and that sort of stuff. And there have been plenty of times that they've documented where, like, just a little camera shift and you'll see the streamer's cheat PC running off to the side. And he's actually running an aimbot. So there have been several streamers who have been like kicked out of the community, but before that have made tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars streaming because people are like, oh my God, this guy or this girl is awesome, right? And it just ends up...
Yeah, I mean, you'd almost want to add in some mistakes and some near misses and things like that, but I don't think they've gotten that sophisticated yet. So this is the proving...
Wait, is that our hacker advice?
Career advice.
A little bit. Well, but think about how much time... The three of us are all professionals. We all have jobs. We all have families. Think about how much time you had when you were younger. Now, I didn't have much time at the military academy, but still, I can imagine people having, you know, massive amounts of time. And this is one way to sharpen their skills. And on their way to be... And they might be great programmers and great hackers in the making. This is where they can cut their teeth.
Well, and it's not as illegal... Well... Let me put it this way. I don't know what the legality of it is necessarily, but it's not...
If you're not selling the cheats, you're probably not going to prison.
Right, but it's not... Imagine, what would you do with those skills if you were, you know, an 18-year-old kid? You're probably not going to get hired by, you know, IBM's X-Force. Right. You could hack Okta, sure, and then maybe go to jail.
If you wait 2 years, you could hack Okta and Microsoft and a bunch of other people.
You could hack Okta. You could create your own ransomware and make the same amount of money. Or, you could hack games, and what happens? Nobody's going to come down.
I think it is. Gateway drug.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Gateway drug to hackers.
I don't know. I'm just saying props to those guys because we have a lot of respect for the guys who dig that deep into kernels and hooking applications.
So maybe you guys should be looking at the highest scoring gamers and hiring them.
Right.
We can't deal with that.
That's... Oh, my God.
It's a good point.
All right. Enough of that. So let's talk about the NSA.
Let's talk about
the NSA. Isn't that a song by Salt and Pepper?
So,
let's talk about the NSA.
I know, NSA.
So, different three-letter word.
Right. So the NSA is actually, you know, a lot of people are always, oh my God, you know, there's always the government's listening and NSA is, you know, NSA is listening to everything we're doing and blah, 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 blah. But honestly, there's a lot of really...
Wrong.
No, but there's a lot of really great work they do.
Of course.
And I think, you know, I think a lot of people throw shade at them for like being the spying organization, but yeah, you know, sometimes you need a spying organization who's going to look for the bad things and make sure they don't happen. And I think this is a great article. This is on Business Insider, just outlining the fact that the NSA is taking much more of an active role in trying to help organizations fend off cyber attacks, specifically from Russia and China. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part about this is they've even gone to the level of creating a little facility that's outside of the perimeter of the NSA that is non-classified so that they can bring in more organizations and talk to them more freely and not have to, you know, have everybody be cleared. And it's only, you know, Fortune 10 companies.
Well, that's good news. I mean, they're basically...
Yeah, the Cybersecurity Collaboration Center.
Yeah, they're moving closer to, you know, people who are getting hit and where they live.
Well, and we say it's good news because
we're American.
My friend Lev.
No, there's a lot of Americans who I think don't trust the NSA.
So there are many Americans who don't trust the NSA, and then there's everyone else in the world who doesn't trust the NSA.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, I frankly think this is a step in the right direction. Honestly, I think civilian companies, we've seen it firsthand. We've seen how easy it is sometimes to break into organizations, and you know, there's things we still can't talk about, but we've seen how easy it is to break into certain departments of state type places. And the fact that the NSA is actually going to that level and helping out is, you know, I applaud them.
Great.
I think that's fantastic.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. I think one of the takeaways from the last few months is that Russia is not the superpower of cyber. China is not the superpower of cyber. The U.S. and much of the West is the superpowers of cyber. And the problem is we haven't been applying our superpowers to help protect our critical infrastructure and our people, because business, we have such a fence. They talk about a fence line. There's such a strong fence between government control and government oversight and the private sector here. This is an attempt to kind of like take those lines and blur them a little bit. Remember back in the old days, they make a joke in the article as well that NSA stood for no such agency. We weren't talking about the NSA, you know, 3 decades ago. It's good to see them and some of the other organizations like CISA who are trying to help us out, because it's going to keep getting worse. The attacks in Ukraine show that cyber is part of warfare now, and part of even during peacetime, we're going to see lots and lots of attacks. They're not going to go down. They're just going to go up.
Well, no, that's okay.
Sorry, bring the mood down.
And, you know, we can sum up the next story with Patch. But this isn't necessarily for you to patch, but your DNS provider to patch. So the story is unpatched DNS bug. That's domain name system. If you remember what that is, that's the phone book for looking up, you know, your contact page for saying, you know, translating google.com into an address that the internet can use. Unpatched DNS bug affects millions of routers and IoT, Internet of Things devices. IoT, Internet of Things devices are computers, but they don't have screens and keyboards usually. They just react to sensors and they communicate with things.
If your refrigerator's on the internet, it's IoT.
Yeah, everybody uses the refrigerator example, but you know, maybe like a camera that is, you know, at your front door, so that you can see who's at the door without getting out of bed.
Yeah, cameras are a good example.
Right.
Thermostats.
Yep.
So who wants to tell us what this DNS bug does and what can be done?
It makes the system vulnerable to DNS poisoning, which is when I call up Carl's phone number, my phone just says Carl's name, but it takes me to his phone number. Imagine if a hacker could go in and change that underlying number so that when I click on Carl's name, it takes me someplace they control.
You wouldn't see the number.
No, because it's still saying, this is Carl's phone. And then it would be up to the pretender, the place I go to convince me it's Carl.
I answer, I sound like, hello? This is Carl.
This is Carl.
And I'll think it's just Carl doing his funny accents. So I'll actually keep talking about
it. Lord, I apologize. I didn't mean to offend anybody. But it is kind of funny.
I'm sorry.
It's a little bit funny.
I'm sorry. So this is a bad thing because it means that systems can go and talk to the wrong back end.
So this is in a DNS, the DNS part of a router, right?
Correct. So some of the routers are patched. Others are not. So this was actually a fork straight from the OpenWRT team. So vendors like Netgear, Access, Linksys, I believe are not currently patched, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Well, this is another good reason to make sure that you buy a local router at your home that automatically updates its firmware.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them do these days, but some of them don't. Mm. So you bring this to the attention of your IT team if you're inside a company that has one.
Right.
And if you're in a small business, you better make sure that you've got the latest firmware.
And I will tell you that right now this is new enough where there's no CVE associated with it, which is just a tracking number, if you will, for exploitation. So you're not going to find a lot of POCs out there yet.
Proofs of concept.
To dial down the panic, though, because there are, I think they said, 200 different vendors that are at risk. To dial down the panic a little bit, it is not super easy to manipulate to get this condition to happen.
It might be possible under certain circumstances.
Right. So it could happen. Always be careful where you're visiting on the internet. Make sure that you have the little green lock up in the upper left-hand corner in the address bar saying you're using SSL, saying you're visiting the right site. But obviously if the site doesn't look right, go to another browser, go to another computer, go to another internet connection. Use your phone as a hotspot. Try that. We do those types of things all the time. So those are good pieces of advice.
So here's a trivia question for you. What's a hacker's favorite breakfast cereal?
Oh man,
Cuckoo Bees, of course. Cuckoo Bees, what the hell is Cuckoo Bees? This is a real thing. Operation Cuckoo Bees.
What the hell is Cuckoo Bees?
Chinese hackers perform rarely seen Windows mechanism abuse in a 3-year campaign. Operation Cuckoo Bees, that's C-U-C-K-O-O, capital B-E-E-S, is an elaborate operation against companies in the U.S. and beyond. This is an article in ZDNet.
I think Carl was so poor, they shopped in off-brand stores.
Oh, probably right.
Wow. I'm sorry, girl. I've never heard of the That's cuckoo right. bees.
Mommy, I want cuckoo bees.
Sounds delicious, though.
He'd go to gym and show off his new Nickies.
Either of you guys want to explain this crazy story?
Yeah, this one's interesting because, you know, we see a lot of APTs, the advanced persistent threats like Cozy Bear and those guys hitting really hard and really fast and trying to get as much, you know, information, you know, access to systems, that sort of stuff as they can. But take these guys. So they're being tracked as APT-41, which is they're also known as Blackfly. So these guys took the opposite approach, which is low and slow.
Like barbecue.
Yeah, exactly. Like a smoker versus, you know, cooking on your range. So what's interesting about that is they don't trip as many of the responses from defenders because you're not seeing 1,000 different attacks. You're seeing very slow approaches.
They're not noisy.
Right. They have some 0 days, so exploits that aren't patched yet that they're using, but they're not using them blatantly. Like, let's get access to every system we possibly can. They'll use these exploits and then start to embed themselves in systems with them. So they'll start to use things like, they're using native logging functionality inside of Windows, what's called the CLFS or the common logging file system. So there's little things they'll use to keep embedding themselves, keep using little 0 days. But they're being as quiet as possible. So it's an interesting approach.
Is this for when the day comes when they want to take over the world and they'll be ready and they just...
This is more of a... I think this is more government-sponsored because government-sponsored is much more patient than, you know, money-motivated.
Interesting.
And that makes them more dangerous. Because if I got 5 years, 10 years to get to you, and just sit and wait. It's a lot easier than if I have to do it this week to make a quota.
Well, and I will tell you, any APT or any really a hacking group that's using 0 days is reasonably well funded. So they're you know, you don't, if you're on the open market as a bug bounty person or as a hacker and you find a 0 day, you're typically selling it because they sell for quite a bit.
So
like, unless you're deploying it in ransomware, then everybody knows about it relatively quickly. Like
APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat. And so it's usually targeting somebody over the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's talk about this awesome, awesome hack. Dwayne, is this awesome or what?
It's so awesome.
Because the title says botnet that hid for 18 months boasted some of the coolest tradecraft ever. All right. So that's why I think you think it's awesome. But what is tradecraft anyway? What is that?
It is awesome.
What is it?
I love tradecraft. So, all right. So tradecraft, and Patrick, I'm sure will, with all of his spook friends, will correct me if I'm wrong, but tradecraft comes out of the spy world. So
spooks don't have friends.
What's a spook? I mean, what are you guys? Sometimes I feel like I just parachuted into the bridge on the Star Trek Enterprise.
Spooks, a jargon for a spy.
Yes. So way before computers, you had tradecraft. And tradecraft was when you had spies, even in the, you know, whether it was the Cold War or whatever, who would, you know, here's how we do a dead drop, right? So where we would mark a place where I'm going to drop some intel. And Patrick, like, for example, there used to be years ago, you used to be able to walk around Washington, D.C., and you would look for chalk marks, like little chalk X's on, sometimes it was benches, sometimes it was next to a mailbox, sometimes it was whatever, and that was a dead drop. There was some piece of information that some spy had taped under a bench or whatever, and his, you know, handler was then supposed to walk by later and see that there was an X there and grab that information and, you know, wipe the X off and walk away.
Tradecraft, it decides whether people get caught.
Yep.
So if the kid, the 16-year-old in the UK that got caught, they had poor operational security, they had bad tradecraft, they bragged, they used traceable accounts, they did things that got them caught. Whereas if you have good tradecraft, you do things that are untraceable, you do things that are very unlikely to be picked up.
I see. So the word just means, you know, craftiness in avoiding being caught.
And it pertains to spying and hacking.
And honestly, a lot of the things they're doing, right on. It's a lot of the same thing. It's a lot of the same things we do when dealing with customers. So part of it, they talk about living off the land, and all living off the land, it is what it sounds like. So a hacking team that lives off the land is one that uses tools that already exist in the hostile environment to do what they need, right? So if I write my own piece of malware, and I deploy it at a customer site, well, that's something new. It's something foreign to the environment. So it's very easy for, you know, defensive tools like antivirus or whatnot to find it. But if I then say, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to use PowerShell. And I'm going to use PowerShell to go add a user or go do whatever I want to do to the system. Well, PowerShell is a tool that exists on, you know, nearly every Windows computer on the planet. So if you're using PowerShell, you're living off the land. You're using tools that already exist that would run normally. So it's much, much harder for you to be detected and what's going on.
So one of the things that jumps out to me in this article is the use of the SOX protocol. And without going into a lot of detail, I like the headline, "A Tunneling Fetish with SOX." You know, if you look up tunneling fetish on the internet, you're going to find something very, very disturbing. Ask me how I know.
That might be about SOX. So, I don't know.
I know what tunneling is. And if you've used a virtual private network, a VPN, you know what tunneling is. Imagine every transmission of data being broken up into chunks called packets. And imagine you can wrap that data in your own sort of envelope. Like you can put the data in an envelope and put stuff on the outside. And you can put that envelope in another envelope and put stuff on the outside of that. And so the actual packet in the inside, that's the actual data you want to send, is considered to be in a tunnel.
and therefore it's protected because right. there's so many outer layers. It's like a non-Russian tank.
Yeah. So that's what these guys basically did, is they found this back door and used some, and living on the land, as you say, using stuff that already exists. They didn't have to install anything. And they had this undetected bot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, for example, imagine, if you will, you're watching even just your home network and you can see everything that's going on in your home network, which is almost impossible. But let's say you could watch all of the traffic coming and going from your home network. And I wanted to break into your network, Carl. And I wanted to put an implant, which is just a hacking term for a piece of code that I'm going to put somewhere where I want to get remote access to your systems. And it could be a rat, could be a total remote access tool, or it could just be it feeds me information, right? So implants really just hide and give me access to your systems that I shouldn't have. What if that implant was sending information over DNS?
DNS.
Right? So instead of making queries for where is Microsoft.com, I say where is some big hex name .hacker.com. And that comes to my DNS server outside. And I take that big hex name and I decode it back into ASCII, and now I know your bank account number or whatever.
Rooster crows at midnight.
Right. So you say, okay, cool. But Dwayne, I would notice that in DNS. I'd see that. And I'd say, okay, cool. What if your computer just started using Gmail? Would you see another background process communicating with Google and sending email on Gmail? Probably not. Your computer sends email on Gmail all the time. You wouldn't see that it was a different account I was connecting to. And maybe what I'm doing is I open up Gmail and I put together an email, which is all the commands that I've run in the output, and I send it to a remote address. And then I reply to that email. I want you to run this and run this and run this. And then every day, my little implant reads email and sees, you know, what commands it should run. So these are the types of tactics we see where it's really hard for you to then know, okay, is my network infected? You know, and that's that, you know, them using these SOX proxies and different type of communication mechanisms is good tradecraft.
That's interesting. And I didn't understand half of it, but I can get the, I can appreciate the awesomeness of the hack. So
if you want to go really deep into hacking tradecraft,
all right,
you let me know. Although, have you guys noticed on a couple of these stories how we're talking about how there's really deep, really intricate hacking teams doing all sorts of really cool stuff, and every single time it seems like Mandiant is the team that's finding
Mandiant. Is that the one that Microsoft just bought
them, didn't they?
Yeah. Wow. It is. It is those the guys one that Microsoft something. Just bought. So it's it was a good pickup, Microsoft. Nice. It's like they got the first draft pick.
All right, we couldn't end this show without a nod to quantum hacking and quantum computing.
This is why I put this one in here.
So this is kind of weird.
Why is it weird?
I don't know. It just seems weird to me. Well, you go with it.
Hey, Patrick. Yeah, you're the expert in quantum. Every time I see, I think somebody's profiling me. I saw that one quantum article. What was it? Last podcast. And I put it in here, and now it seems like it pops up all over the place. But Patrick, I wanted your take on this. President Biden, this is a NSA.gov article. So President Biden signs a memo to combat quantum computing threat.
This is real.
Straight out of Fort Meade.
This is super real.
He obviously doesn't know how.
Well, yeah, we do know how.
Well, no, but President Biden doesn't, you know.
Well, but he listens to his advisors, because otherwise this wouldn't have come out.
So it's a memo that says, hey, guys, watch out for quantum computing. You got to watch out for that.
Actually, it goes far beyond that, because General Nakasone from Cyber Command is involved. So here's the thing, and I think I've talked about this before. When quantum computers evolve somewhat further than they are today, which isn't
it's pretty soon
tomorrow, though. It's probably not next year, but it's probably this decade. And I know that's controversial, but I can defend that stance. I think before the end of this decade, there'll be a quantum computer somewhere that can break RSA 2048. Now, RSA 2048 is pretty secure
of the day
encryption, and it's what people would consider the backbone of the internet. If it's vulnerable, then most of the stuff we care about is vulnerable. And what this is saying is there are already the NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, is already identifying other quantum other non-quantum, other standard encryptions that can be used that are not vulnerable to quantum. And so what this is saying is agencies and organizations in the government have to start moving to those encryption standards. None of them are quantum based. This doesn't require quantum computing to prevent the attacks from quantum computers, because that would mean you'd have to wait until this is. Let's have an analogy. So I'm trying to attack Carl. I'm a nation state and I want to attack Carl. Carl's using encryption that I can't break. But what I can do is I can gather all the data that I see encrypted and store it long term. And when I get a quantum computer sufficient, I can then break it and then I can read it. Okay. Well, if the information is artillery locations, that won't be useful. But if it's nuclear missile silos or mining sites or other trade secrets, that's a problem, because that has a life expectancy beyond 10 years. And so we're now within 10 years of when quantum computers can break this stuff. So we need to get on our little bike now and start pedaling towards a future where we use encryption that's not breakable by quantum. And that means things like lattice-based encryption, NTRU, lattice, and other encryption mechanisms that are being recommended by NIST.
So it's an encryption mechanism that works today, non-quantum, and will be able to work tomorrow against quantum.
Because we don't currently have a way for quantum to break it, but we do see a path, a very clear path, for quantum to break the current encryption everyone is using.
Yeah.
And that includes RSA, Diffie-Hellman, and elliptical curve. All three of those will be toast if we have a decent-sized, functioning, and standardized quantum computer.
Can you name them again? They sound familiar. Can you name again?
RSA.
Yeah.
Diffie-Hellman.
Yeah.
Elliptical curve.
Those are the guys I hung out with in high school.
That's right.
Especially Diffie-Hellman. I remember Diffie-Hellman.
Diffie-Hellman was definitely there. I remember Diffie-Hellman.
Yeah, he owned the bodega down the street.
Yeah, his parents owned the liquor store.
This is us trying to get ahead of something that we're probably already not ahead on. The only good news is the rest of the world is behind too. There's no indication that I've seen that anyone in the world is ahead in this. I'd have to double check on China, but I don't think anybody is already using the lattice-based encryption.
Well, that is a show. Thank you, guys. It's always fun talking to you.
Thanks.
And we learned a few good things, too.
Times. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know,
I can't wait to see what next week brings.
Another token quantum article, I hope.
Hopefully some awesome new hacks.
Next week, it's going to be Hack Dwayne Day.
Bring it.
Bring it.
Bring it.
All right, guys. See you later.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.